Happy Wednesday. It is the Wednesday morning podcast. What's the crack? How are you getting on? I hope you've been well. I hope you had a wonderful Christmas. I am very happy to report that we are 10 weeks at number one on the podcast charts, which I'm humbled by, unbelievably humbled. When I started this podcast 10 weeks ago, there's 400,000 of you have listened to this podcast and growing. 10 weeks ago, this is where I thought I'd be in a year or 2 years. You know, I genuinely believed that this podcast was going to start off small and I'd stick with it and it would very humbly grow. And it just went mental. You know, we've got something like 200,000 listeners in Ireland, 60,000-70,000 listeners in the UK, 10 or 15 in the US, a few more in Canada and Australia. I can't believe it, lads. But thank you very much. Thank you for subscribing to the podcast and thank you very much for leaving lovely reviews. And please continue to do so and recommend the podcast to a friend. So, what happened last week? Well, I gave you a little short story there on Christmas Day as a present. A short story about a pigeon. And I tried to keep it a little bit family friendly. I hope you enjoyed it. And I hope you had a wonderful Christmas. I left you last week with a message about Christmas, about the importance of, you know, how Christmas can be a bit difficult for some people. Because, you know, you go back to your family of origin. And, you know, if you've got issues with people in your family or people in your family have issues with you, fights can happen and drink is involved. And the other thing too, and I forgot to mention this last week, whenever you're in any situation around your family, you can end up psychologically regressing to a time of childhood because, you know, that's what you associate with your family. So your capacity for rational adult behaviour becomes quite diminished when you're around your family. So it's another thing to have in your awareness. I cut the podcast short last week because I had to go for a mandatory seaweed bath, which was odd, I'll be honest. It was, you know, it was a little bit relaxing. I'm in a warm bath full of seaweed and there's, you know, candles and it was nice, but I just felt like a giant teabag. You know, I felt like a teabag and the seaweed wasn't particularly pleasant. I was kind of like, look, can I just have the bath and get the fucking seaweed out of the bath, please? Because I kept imagining fucking an octopus or a crab coming out and biting my knee. And it smelt like sushi. Do you know that seaweed miso kind of smell you get off sushi? So I would not be recommending a seaweed bath for anybody. It's up to you if you want to do it. I'd rather bathe in soap and furry things like that, you know, with nice smells like lavender or sandalwood, but not seaweed. I don't know why anybody would do that. It was forced upon me. But if mandatory seaweed baths are my biggest complaint, then I think I'm doing pretty okay in the scale of things to be complaining about and worrying about. But I won't be doing it again. Last week we also spoke about Northern Soul and my hot take, which correlated Northern Soul with rave music, which I think was about 90% accurate. There was one fact, however. Well, I can't call it a fact. I mentioned that Northern Soul records made their way to Manchester and places like that as a ballast on coal ships. And a few people were wondering, where did I find that out? Because I couldn't find it online. And it doesn't exist online. I found that out because a buddy of mine was doing a PhD in subcultures. And he told me this. So it's more hearsay. And what I'll say about it, it's a very, very interesting fact. And any time a fact appears to be too interesting, always take it with a pinch of salt. That's what I say. Do you know what it's like with conspiracy theories? Conspiracy theories are, they're the most interesting story, you know, because the truth is often too boring. So we latch on to the theory that seems the most entertaining, the theory that we'd like to see as a movie. One thing I did learn last week, which is quite beneficial, I speak about music quite a lot, and I was concerned last week that I was speaking about, you know, a very specific type of music, but I wasn't able to show ye any audio examples. And I did a bit of research, and it should be okay for me to occasionally play snippets of music if I am critically analysing or reviewing or commenting on that music. Then you can kind of get away with it under a fair use license. So I'm going to see about doing that. I was worried about iTunes flagging any tunes and then getting the podcast ripped offline. As you know, I set up a Patreon page, patreon.com/theblindboypodcast. And a few of you who've been very generous, thank you very much. And you've been donating some money to the Patreon. And like I say with the Patreon, if you want to give a few quid, do. If you don't want to give a few quid, if you can't afford it, no worries. That's no problem at all. Makes no difference. It's just a goodwill gesture. And the podcast is still going to continue, even if I get nothing in the Patreon. Having said that though, as a little treat, for the Patreon donators, this week I'm going to have a very brief appearance from a little guest. I'm going to have a guest on the podcast this week, and I've given him a little contributor's fee to make a short report on a topic that I chose for him. And I'd like you all to welcome now the Trout of No Crack. How have you been, sir?
By the kid, you know yourself, apples and oranges, you know?
Yeah, I'm going to ask you to move a little bit closer up to the mic there, just a little bit close, because I can't hear you.
Up around here, is it? Yeah? All right, sir, what you want me to do? What you want me to do? Is that the mic?
It is, yeah. If you don't know the Trout of No Crack, he's a long-time collaborator. He's a trout, he's an actual trout. He's a brother of the mythical fish, the salmon of knowledge, is that right?
Yes, salmon of knowledge, yes, that's my brother.
Yeah, and what I asked him was to make a short radio piece. And you suggested to me a topic that you wanted to do a radio piece on.
Well, that's right, what I wanted to do, I've recently joined a gym, and I've met a good crew of boys in the gym. Got Claire and Sally and a few more. And what we've started doing in the gym, it's a new type of training where we rack out a line of Keanu Reeves, snort it and bench press like lunatics. And I wanted to do a report on that.
Yeah, and I got your email with that request, but that's not in fitting with the tone of the show or the tone of the podcast at all. So what we agreed upon...
You agreed.
...was that you were going to do a radio report on Japanese city pop, electronic Japanese music from the 1980s. Isn't that right?
Well, I didn't really want it, to be honest, like, but you were giving me 50 quid, which is a bit stingy, to be honest, you know. But I did, yeah. I did. I have a small report here now. I have it here on a disc somewhere. I'm trying it in. It's on Japanese city pop. Do you want to hear it?
Okay, we put that in. This is a special report on 1980s Japanese city pop from the Trout of No Crack.
Tokyo, 1981. The Japanese economy had experienced a massive boom due to its electronic exports. These were the sounds that defined that era. Japanese city pop, a disco funk jazz fusion genre, which was the soundtrack to a capitalistic optimism. While the emphasis of the music was on audio fidelity, it had its roots in the earlier music of Yellow Magic Orchestra, the project of Ryuichi Sakamoto. The fidelity and mastery of electronic sounds is evident in this song, known as Raiden, from 1979. Fair play, Ryuichi.
わびさびというか、わびさびってのは人に対する思
い。 Japanese city pop would be my favorite type of music. If you come up to me with another type of music, you can go fuck yourself, cuz I've no interest in anything else. Like seriously, I swear down onto the holy picture, Japanese city pop, listening to it in my car, inside my Toyota, all day long. And if you come up to me with anything else, man, you can be picking glass out of your face. Fucking God, step down. In my own personal opinion, Japanese city pop came into its own in the mid-80s with the work of Hiroshi Sato and his song Shiny Lady.
No. No.
What's wrong?
Man, I'm trying to create a podcast hug for these people. I'm trying to create a relaxing... A relaxing environment.
Yeah.
Like, how did you even... Did you? It sounds like you recorded that in a phone box.
Sounds fine to me, cuz. Like, sounds
I fine gave you
to
access
me.
To the studio and everything. Like, how the fuck...
€50 If you're going to be cheap with the contribution fee, that's what you're getting. €50 cuz...
No, man, you voiced over a Japanese man, and you don't even speak then Japanese. Like,
what? Fee for translating then as well. I turn it into Google Translate. It's all the same to me, all right? What? I don't listen to Japanese fucking city pop. I want to talk about Don Keanu Reeves in the gym with the bass.
I should have done that report on Japanese city pop myself. I should not have contracted the assistance of the Trouter Nor Crack. I apologise. There will be better effort in future.
No, fuck that. I'm going anyway. Look, do you know what, man? A podcast is an effeminate medium. You're emasculating yourself. You're making a cuck out of yourself. I'm leaving. And it's not just me saying that. There's a few people around town and they're saying that you're using an effeminate medium. You're emasculating yourself. You're a cuck, man. You're a cuck. Goodbye.
The Trout of No Crack there with his report on Japanese city pop music. Which is a... It's a genre of music that I stumbled across recently on YouTube. And I like it just because it's weird, do you know? I wouldn't find myself listening to it loads, but it brings me on to the topic of this podcast, which is I want to talk a bit about Japan and Eastern culture. Japanese city pop is a type of music that came about because of technological advancement. The vast majority of electronic instruments were invented by the Japanese. Synthesizers and drum machines were all Japanese inventions that were put into use mainly by Western artists. But the Japanese themselves absolutely nailed the use of these instruments. It's just, we'd never heard this music over here at all. And I stumbled across Japanese city pop on YouTube. You won't find it on iTunes, you won't find it on Spotify, because it's too rare. But now you're getting people kind of uploading that 80s music. And it's mad complex. If you're into jazz and stuff, like, Jesus, the musicianship on it is phenomenal. But mainly... It was being made to be listened to in cars because the sound systems in Japanese cars in the 80s were phenomenal. So the music was being made to match the fidelity of these sound systems. And the Japanese have always been very advanced with technology. Now, there's a few theories behind it. One of the theories is as a result of the Hiroshima bombings. Japan is the only country that has had nuclear weapons used against its civilian population, right? The Nagasaki and Hiroshima bombs killed hundreds of thousands of people in a flash. They're the only culture and society that has come close to an apocalypse, and you see this reflected in their art and culture. If you grew up watching anime, things like Akira, if you've ever seen Akira, there's an obsession with post-apocalyptic themes because... That's what they grew up with. That's what the post-war Japan was. We almost got wiped off the planet. But the bombings in Nagasaki and Hiroshima, they ended World War II. And the Japanese immediately surrendered, which is something within Japanese culture you didn't do. They had kamikaze pilots, which were pilots that would fly their planes into US warships, suicide pilots, because... To die by the sword was more honourable than to be defeated in battle. So the Yanks' logic in dropping those atomic bombs was like, we're never going to beat the Imperial Japanese in conventional warfare. They'll never give up. So we got to freak them out with nuclear power. And that's what happened.
Well, almost. The other thing that the Yanks had planned, and this is nuts, they did a lot of firebombing of Japan because Japanese buildings were wooden. So the Yanks, the craziest plan that the Yanks had come up with to freak out Japan is that they were going to attach firebombs onto flocks of flying bats. And the plan was is attach a little firebomb to a flock of bats. The bats would go to Japanese cities and hang upside down in rafters. Then in America, they'd press a button and all the bats would explode at once with firebombs and set fire to Japan. That was an actual plan that almost happened. But the Yanks said, fuck that, no. We'll drop two nuclear bombs on them instead. And if they don't surrender, we're going to keep dropping nuclear bombs on their cities and eradicate them. So after Japan surrendered, the world powers kind of pressured them into... The world powers got scared because Imperial Japan, they were vicious, incredibly vicious. The nationalism that Japan had was very extreme. They aligned themselves with Hitler, and the war crimes that they committed in Asia were some of the most disgusting that World War II had seen. The rape of Nanking, which was a massacre in China, where rape was used as a systematic weapon of war. One of them, a horrendous, horrendous spectacle of humanity. The Japanese committed that. The West were afraid that after they bombed the Japanese with these nuclear bombs, that they would retaliate, that they would go silent for a while and then learn to retaliate. So many sanctions were brought in against the Japanese. The main one was that they were not allowed to import any decent quality steel up until the 1990s. There was an embargo on Japan importing high quality steel for military reasons. Japan was forced to agree to not expand its military, and it took up a position of military pacifism. So the older listeners of this podcast will remember when you were younger, if you grew up in the 70s or 80s, that Japanese cars, Toyotas and Suzukis, they would have had different coloured doors or bonnets. You might have seen a yellow car with a red door or a green bonnet. And that's because Japanese cars used to fall apart. They used to rust because they weren't allowed to have decent steel. But the upside to this embargo is that it forced Japanese scientists and workers to focus their ingenuity on the inside of the car. So you ended up with Japanese cars that fell apart, but the insides were absolutely amazing. The technology on the inside, the radio, the suspension, the lot was perfect. Again, this technological advancement is what led to the creation of Japanese city pop music, because technology was their thing. You don't need high-grade steel to make a decent radio. But there's other stuff about Japan that just makes it appear to be a country that has its shit together. As a society, it appears to work more efficiently than other societies. They've one of the lowest rates of violent crime in the world for a population of its size. Now, what some say this comes down to is what's known as collectivism. And collectivism is, it's something that we in the West don't fully relate to. There's kind of a split in Eastern and Western thinking that goes back years and years. And in the East, countries tend to be collectivistic in nature, whereas in the West, we're individualistic. Now, what collectivism is that it's the principle of giving a group priority over each individual in it. That the way that you think as a whole, not as an individual. Whereas we in the West, we tend to think of ourselves first, and then the group that we are a part of comes second. Our society comes second, but we are number one. That's not how it works in the East. We in the West, our individualism kind of hangs on the fact that the tenets of our culture and society come from Greek and Roman philosophy, okay, which is tends to be individualistic. For me, one of the shining examples of this is the word pupil, as in your eye, the pupil in your eye. That comes from a Latin word. Well, no, it comes from originally Greek. And what pupil literally means is little doll. The word for pupil is when you look into another person's eye, you see a little doll reflection of yourself in their eye. And that, to me, sums up our Western individualistic thought, that our very word for this eye, that you're not even looking into another person's eyes, you're merely looking at your own tiny reflection in their pupil. That, to me, is the core of Western individualism. Even taking it so far as, you know, I, as in the thing that's in your head that you see through, and the word I, as in me, are the same fucking sound. That is quite an egotistical, individualistic, the language there, you know, the core of the language there. But in Eastern culture, it's quite different. Eastern cultures are collectivist. There isn't really an I, it's a whole, it's holistic. That a person cannot exist by themselves, that they are part of a greater system and serve a purpose. Do you remember growing up on TV, you'd see footage from China or Japan, and you'd see people in the subway wearing face masks. And I always grew up thinking, Jesus, you selfish fuckers, wearing a face mask so you don't get sick. I always looked at that and I thought it was quite rude, that if I was to walk around Limerick with a face mask on, that I'd look like a hypochondriac. If someone carries hand sanitizer around with them in Ireland, if you shake somebody's hand and take out the hand sanitizer, it's like calling the other person dirty. It's like, I'm cleaning my hands because I just touched you. And I used to always think this when I saw people in the East wearing the face masks. And then I found out the reason that Japanese people or South Korean people wear face masks in public is because they're sick and they don't want to give it to somebody else. That is collectivistic thought. They are protecting society from their germs. It has nothing to do with getting germs off someone else. And I, as a Westerner, I couldn't even relate to that without projecting selfishness on them. Holistic thinking is also one of the kind of tenets of collectivist thought and how it differs from Western individualist thinking. Holistic thinking means that the parts of something are only explainable by reference to the whole, okay? That no one thing exists by itself, that everything is interconnected. The ancient Chinese had this figured out years ago. Westerners would have looked at the planets and seen each planet as just, and it, you know, they'd look off into the stars and see them as individual planets. Whereas the ancient Chinese had figured out that the moon and how close it is to the earth and gravity affects the tides. And that's an insane jump of thinking for us, but not when you think in a holistic fashion, because the ancient Chinese knew that, like, the moon can influence the tides. Yeah, it's all part of the same, it's all the one. But in the West, we only learned this recently through scientific evidence and through testing and through proving it. We didn't have to make that leap of judgment. Would have been too much for our individualistic culture. But even like something as modern and as advanced as quantum physics is proving to be holistic in nature, because they're showing now, like out with the Large Hadron Collider, that a quantum particle, if it's separated from another quantum particle, even though they're far apart, doing something to one will influence the other, even though they're not connected. So the very fabric of what makes up our reality is most likely holistic. Psychologists carry out studies on societies from individualistic ways of thinking and collectivist ways of thinking to try and find evidence to see if this culture affects how we actually perceive and how we innately think. And there's one survey they carried out where they got three words, bus, train and tracks. And they asked people which two of those words go together. So when they went to the Western countries, the individualists, the responses were overwhelming that bus and train go together. Because that's an abstract analytic thought. That is, bus and train are forms of transport. But when they went to Eastern individualist or collectivist cultures, the answers were that train and tracks went together. Because the train and the track are part of a whole, they're part of a system, they're holistic. An area of Japan that's quite interesting in this respect is there's a part of northern Japan called Hokkaido, or Hokkaido, and it's an island, and it was only very recently inhabited. It was inhabited around 1871. It was just at the very tip of Japan at the top, and there was only indigenous tribes living there. The Japanese decided, they were freaking out about that Russia was going to invade them. So they told the Japanese people, and they got Americans involved as well, to colonize this northern island and to treat it like a frontier. And now what they find is that the people living in Hokkaido have a very different cognitive profile to the rest of Japan. They exhibit ways of thinking and cultural ways of seeing themselves that are more individualistic than collectivistic. They're much more prouder of success. They're more ambitious for personal growth and they're less connected to the people around them. And this is quite different to the rest of Japan. Hokkaido was created around frontierism, like the American Wild West. And this is why now there are cultural similarities between the two communities. Because this Japanese collectivism is one of the reasons behind their technological advancement. They just work well in teams, and a team is better than a group of individuals. A team is concerned with the overall goal. It's not concerned with individual egos. And this is good and it's bad. It's very bad when nationalism becomes, you know, when that comes to the boil. As you can see, as evidenced by the behaviour of Imperial Japan, who were a shower of ghouls. Also as well, the racists in the West look towards Japan as a society that kind of are on the ball when it comes to racial purity. Japan have very tight immigration laws. They've got very tight laws around foreigners getting in. It's quite a racist society. So I'm not saying that collectivism is necessarily a good thing. Marxism is an attempt at bringing collectivist thought to Western individualistic capitalism. It borrows from Eastern collectivist ideas. So where am I going with this? Like, what I want to get at is why and how does this happen? Why in the West, for many, many years, are we more individualistic in our thinking and in how we traverse our society? And then the people in the East are collectivist. Well, what it comes down to, what people are saying, what anthropologists are saying, it comes down to the growing of crops, right? And this predates, you know, this predates philosophy. If you look at the philosophy of the East, it is collectivist. You've got Confucianism, Buddhism, Taoism. And then on the West, we've got the Western Greek and Roman philosophers that were individualistic. It comes down to the primary source of carbohydrate in these different parts of the world. Mainly rice versus wheat. In cultures where rice was being grown, the very practice of growing rice is collectivist in nature. To grow rice, it requires intense cooperation from every single member of the community. Very complex dredging, big paddy fields, planning for floods, sowing the rice seeds. If you don't look after your neighbour, then you don't eat. Countries that are collectivist in their society also happen to have depended upon the growing of rice as their civilization developed. Western civilization, however, depended upon the growing of wheat. And wheat farming, it takes about half the amount of work and it depends on rainfall rather than irrigation. So collaboration it's not as necessary with growing wheat. So Western society ended up being quite individualistic and a little bit selfish. And they've found this in China, because China's fucking massive. Not all of China depended upon rice. Some of China in the north were able to grow wheat. Culturally, the wheat growing areas of China are much more similar in thought to Westerners. They're individualistic. And the rice growing areas are Eastern. They're collectivistic. And this is why Japanese people will put a mask on their face if they're sick. It's why illegal downloading in Japan was basically non-existent up until about 10 years ago. And it's why crime is so low. And that is today's hot, hot take of the podcast. And I'd like to thank the Trout of No Crack for facilitating this to happen. We'll leave a little pause now for the advert. And I'm going to look for my Spanish whistle, my ocarina, so we can have the weekly ocarina pause for the advert.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
So you may or may not have heard an advert there. How are you getting on with your looking after your mental health? As you know, as I always mention, this is not a mental health podcast, but because I'm a person who is actively and continually maintaining their mental health, it's going to creep in every so often, and I'd like to include you in my mental health journey. Because it was Christmas there, and because with Christmas your schedule gets fucked up, I went about 3 or 4 days without any exercise. And it really and truly made me realise, just, you know, for me personally, that exercise is my natural antidepressant. I'll run 4 days a week. I'll go to the gym the other three. One thing that I find crucial in what keeps me doing this, I don't do it for physical fitness. I don't do it to look a certain way. I used to do that when I was younger, and I found that when I was going to the gym or when I was trying to exercise for physical results, that's when I found myself going very intensely for a while and then giving it up, not being able to stick with it. And this came into my head recently when someone on Twitter gave me a very controversial question, which was, do I believe that fat shaming is a good thing if it results in someone going to the gym? And I thought about it, and it's like, no, I don't think it's a good thing. Because if someone is shamed for their body, or someone is bullied about their appearance, and this then does actually motivate them to go and try and change this through exercise or through dieting or whatever, what it does is it's only ever going to be short term. If you engage in any type of exercise or self-improvement and the end goal is something as tangible as your appearance or your weight, then the nature of it means that you're going to give up, because what you're searching for is a happiness, and that you can't get that happiness, because the happiness can only come from self-acceptance, not by trying to change yourself. And I've been steadily exercising every day for about 4 years, and what has kept me at it is I do it because I enjoy the process. I go out for a run because I want the experience of running. I want the release of endorphins in my mind and my body. When I go to the gym, I like to lift weights so I can get that release of endorphins in my body. I'm not going into the mirror afterwards or measuring myself or hoping for any goals, physical goals. If they happen anyway, great. All right, who gives a shit? But I exercise for the sheer love of the process because, like I said, that is my body's natural antidepressants. And I had about 4 or 5 days out there over Christmas, or 3 days, where I did no exercise whatsoever. And after about 2 days, I found myself being slightly irritable. I found myself lacking massively in energy, having that feeling of sluggishness where your skin feels itchy. And I found that my thoughts were becoming negative. When I was thinking about the challenges ahead of me for 2018, such as I'm working on 2 TV projects and I've got a book to write. When I was thinking about these things, my mind was focusing on what could go wrong. It wasn't focusing on what could go right. And I found this was because I wasn't exercising. Whatever exercise does to my brain, whatever oxygen it gets around the body, it very much equips me for base level stress. And then as soon as I got out and went fucking running, then of course I started to become more positive in my thinking. I wasn't feeling angry at myself or angry at other people. I was just a nice base level of calm. And if a stressor comes at me, I was dealing with it as it comes. And that's what exercise does for me. Not to be facetious as well, lads, and I said this last week, I know what it feels like to have hardcore depression and hardcore anxiety. And I know how difficult it is to even get off the couch. But that's just me. That's where I am. It took me many, many years to get to the stage where I can exercise every day. I've done the struggle and this is where I'm at now. And I appreciate it. For you, that sounds impossible. If you do want to start running, if it's something you're thinking about, like there's a lot of people as well. Like, I mean, some people are embarrassed to go running. You know, I remember I used to be like that. You're embarrassed to even be out there doing the running. You think people are looking at you, think people are judging you. And I know what that feels like. It's not the case though. No one gives a shit about you running. Chances are if someone sees you running, they're a little bit jealous that you're running and they're not. But if you do want to give it a lash, I would suggest download a Couch to 5K app. And these are apps that will, you just listen to it and it will gradually train you over about 6 weeks to go from sitting on your couch to actually running 5 kilometres. And it's hard at the start. Exercise is awful at the start, but it gets grand. I was actually thinking, and I might do it for 2018, I might do a special podcast that is my own Couch to 5K for anyone who's interested in running. And what I'll do is I will take you through a very basic resting, running for a half hour until there's 5K in it. Maybe I might do that, maybe make a few tunes that go with your heartbeat or something. Why not? But yeah. So I wasn't exercising for a while and I found my thoughts becoming quite negative, and when I was looking at projects ahead of me, I was focusing on the negatives. And when your mental health starts to go astray, we look at challenges in a very irrational fashion. We'll say, this second book that I have to write, if I'm irritable or if I'm not, you know, handling stress, I will look at that book as a mountain. I will treat it like, if someone says write a book, I will assume that they're saying there's a mountain, I want you to jump it. and then I'll freak out because it's like, I can't jump a mountain, look at the size of it. Whereas the rational way to look at any project that's ahead of you, or not even a project, it could be washing the dishes, always be cautious when you think you're telling yourself you need to jump a mountain. That is an irrational thought process. The way you go at a project is you have to climb the mountain. You're going to set up a base camp and then you're going to climb a little bit every single day. And I think when it comes to happiness, human happiness, it doesn't come from results. Happiness is enjoying a journey. That's what happiness is. I loved writing that book last year. But when I finished the book, and even when I got it published and saw it in shops, that did not make me feel happy at all. In fact, it made me feel a strange emptiness, because you get this feeling of, oh, it's done now, is that it? And the happiness was the journey. In anything that you do, happiness comes from the enjoyment of that journey. And the trick is, when you get to your destination, just figure out where the next destination is. Don't think that the end of that journey, at the end of it, is going to be happiness. That's not how it works. Happiness happens along the way. And when it does happen, you don't even notice that's the case. Humans are goal-focused. We do well when we have a little horizon, a little spot ahead in the horizon to always be looking at and moving towards. But once we get to that point, we can be left with an existential dread and an existential loneliness. So keep moving. Whatever it is, keep moving. It's like the rainbow and the pot of gold. The rainbow is what's beautiful. You know, when you try and chase that rainbow, there's no pot of gold. There's nothingness. So keep looking up at the rainbow. Keep chasing it. But fuck the pot of gold. It doesn't exist. I once knew an American man who thought leprechauns were called leprechians. Speaking of American men, I think about this time in the podcast, I'd like to read out some of Donald Trump, President of America. I'd like to read out his tweets as your drunk Limerick aunt. So this week, your Limerick aunt is, she's over at your house because it's Christmas. And you're all sitting around, you want to watch Die Hard or whatever. And she's on the Baileys. And she's got a hair up her arse. And she's slurring her words. And she whispers into your ear, I hope everyone is having a great Christmas. Then tomorrow it's back to work in order to make America great again. Which is happening faster than anyone has anticipated. Based on the fact that the very unfair and unpopular individual's mandate has been terminated as part of our tax bill, which essentially repeals over time. Obamacare, the Democrats and Republicans will eventually come together and develop a great new healthcare plan. All signs are that business is looking really good next year. Only to be helped further by our tax cut bill. Will be a great year for companies and jobs. Stock market is poised for another year of success. Throwing shapes all over the place. That was Donald Trump's last three tweets. As of the 27th of December, the year of our Lord, 2017. Last week I recommended an album for ye. Some people have been asking me to recommend the albums at the end of the podcast so that ye can go and listen to them at the end of the podcast and not three quarter way of the podcast. I don't know how I feel about that. I like putting the album recommendation in three quarters of the way through the podcast. So maybe write the name of the album down that I recommend now, and then you look at that at when the podcast ends. You take personal responsibility for it, Simon, who tweeted that. Last week I recommended the album, the Blue album by Jameson, JMSN, which is a lovely contemporary R&B album with divine production. And I hope you had listened to that and enjoyed it. This week, I'd like to recommend, it's another Tom Waits album. I recommended Blue Valentines by Tom Waits about 6 or 7 podcasts ago. That's early Tom Waits, 1973, when he was in his jazz period. I would like to now recommend Swordfish Trombones by Tom Waits, which is a start-to-finish fantastic album. And it's when Tom Waits went very avant-garde with his career. It's from 1980. He met a woman called Kathleen Brennan, who I think is, I think she's from Cork, or if not her, her family. And Tom Waits was listening to the music of Captain Beefheart. My fucking mouth has gone to shit. Tom Waits was listening to Captain Beefheart, who is a bit of a gas cunt and a mad bastard. And Tom really came into his own sound. He developed a bizarre, violent type of sound for Swordfish Trombones. And again, he elevated songwriting to the art of the short story in this album. In particular, a song called Shore Leave, which is just fucking beautiful. Shore Leave is amazing. Listen to the lyrics on that song. Fuck me. It is a short story, start to finish. Amazing. Swordfish Trombones by Tom Waits. Give it a spin, please. It is time to answer some of the questions that you ask me on Twitter at Rubber Bandits. You can also ask me questions if you want in the review section of the podcast in iTunes, because I do read those as well. Connor O'Reilly asks, any Irish mythology that you haven't already chatted about? I absolutely love that crack. Yes. And I'm going to tell you a story. Now, most Irish people will know this story, but considering that there's 60,000 people listening from the UK and then another 20 or so odd from other parts of the world, or 30,000 people listening, I can't assume that you all know about Irish mythology. So I'm going to tell you the story of the Salmon of Knowledge, which is one that we all kind of know if you're Irish, but it's still a fucking great story. Earlier on, I had on the podcast the Trout of No Crack. And the Trout of No Crack, as I mentioned, he is a brother of the Salmon of Knowledge. And the Trout of No Crack is, he's a prick. He's an asshole. He's a racist. He's a loudmouth. He calls cocaine Keanu Reeves. He bench presses. He bullies people. He's a dickhead. And he's a bit of a fool. And he made shit of that. He had a wonderful opportunity there to represent Japanese city pop in all its beauty, and he didn't. He fucked it up. He recorded it in a phone box, and he put that 50 quid up his nose, or gambled it. But I will tell you the story of his brother, the Salmon of Knowledge, which I believe is from the Fenian cycle of Irish mythology. And the story goes, there's a lad called Fionn McCool, and there was this regular salmon knocking around a lake up north of Ireland. And there was a tree, this tree that contained a load of wisdom in the tree. It was a hazelnut tree. So the salmon anyway ate 9 hazelnuts that fell into the water from this tree. The salmon ate these hazelnuts. So as a result of this, the salmon, whose name was Fintan the salmon, gained all of the world's knowledge. So fast forward anyway a few years to this poet called Finnegas. Now Finnegas knew about this salmon, Fintan, who'd ate the hazelnuts and had all the world's knowledge. And Finnegas was a poet, so he's like, well, fuck that, man. I want to get all the knowledge in the world, because can you imagine the state of the poems I'd be writing if I knew everything in the world? It'd be like having Wikipedia before Wikipedia. So Finnegas the poet dedicated his life fishing and catching this salmon of knowledge so that he could eat Fintan the salmon and then take all the world's knowledge. So one day, Fionn McCool decides he's going to help Finnegas catch the salmon, you know, just to be sound, because Fionn McCool was a young lad. and he'd seen that Finnegas was 7 years trying to catch this fish. So he gives him a help for a couple of weeks. Then one day, Finnegas catches the fucking salmon. He can't believe it. It's like, I'm after catching the salmon knowledge. Holy fucking shit. So Finnegas, anyway, he puts the salmon on a spit over the fire, ready to cook it. Salmon's cooking away, and Finnegas the poet needs to take a shit. So he fucks off into a bush to take a shit. And Fionn McCool is left looking after the cooking salmon. While Fionn is turning the salmon over the fire, he notices that a bubble starts to form on the skin of the salmon. Now, Fionn doesn't want the salmon to be ruined. He doesn't want it bursting. So he sticks his thumb into this bubble, that the heat bubble that formed on the fish's skin, and bursts it. But it burns his thumb. And then he sucks his thumb because it was sore. And fucking Fionn McCool ends up getting all the knowledge from Fintan the Salmon. The world's knowledge goes into Fionn McCool and not Finnegas. Finnegas went fucking apeshit, but eventually was quite happy that Fionn McCool, the hero, attained all the world's knowledge. And then many, 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 many years later, we went looking for the trout, for the salmon of knowledge, and ended up catching the trout of no crack instead. And he's been hanging around with us ever since, being a burden on our lives. Now, I love the story of the salmon of knowledge. One of the reasons I do love it so much is that there's no evidence of that story in other cultures. I told you a few weeks ago about King Sweeney and the king with the donkey's ears. That story is present in a lot of cultures, but the salmon of knowledge is uniquely Irish. And what jumps up, to use a pun, what jumps out of the water the most for me about that story is that the salmon attained his knowledge from eating fucking hazelnuts. Like, salmon don't eat, salmon don't give a shit about hazelnuts, lads. So some fella was sitting down one day, some poet or somebody who come up with this myth, and he was obviously looking at a hazel tree over a river, and the salmon were obviously jumping for flies, and he assumed that the salmon were eating hazelnuts. Salmon's never going to... What? When have you ever seen a salmon to give a shit about nuts? And I just thought that was brilliant, you know? That the hazelnut could give the salmon the eternal wisdom of the world. Fair play to whoever come up with that, however many thousands of years ago that was. Jennifer Wilson asks, cats or dogs? I hate that question because I hate the way we have dogs and cats in competition with each other. They're both different creatures, and they both have different purposes, and I love dogs and cats equally, and it breaks my heart when I compare the two. It genuinely does. I love them both, and they have different personalities. One thing I will say, and I'm not even going to try compare them, but I'm going to just make a few respective points. The one thing I'll say about cats is that a cat is a real creature. A dog is not a real creature. Dogs are created by human beings. A dog does not exist in the wild. Dogs have been knocking about with humans for over 100,000 years, maybe longer, okay? And there's no such thing as a dog. They're completely domesticated. What happened is that when humans were hunter-gatherers, right? Wolves would, you know, packs of wolves, because a wolf is, that's a real animal. Wolves would hang around with humans, and the friendlier wolves would involve themselves in our social circles, and they would help us hunt. And some of them would hang around and, you know, they would defend us. And the most amicable wolves basically bred with other amicable wolves until eventually a creature was created by humans called a dog. And they've done this in Russia. There's a type of Russian fox where they showed over only, it only took them 60 years. They got wild foxes and they started breeding only the most amicable and friendly foxes until after about 60 years, there's this new fox and it doesn't even look like a fox anymore. It looks like a dog. Dogs' faces and their expressions have evolved to mimic human expressions. Dogs have been with us for years and years and years. And we have molded what they are, you know. Even, you know, there's purebred dogs and they shouldn't even exist. Poor old pugs. A pug can drown in his own spit if he falls on his face, you know. They're not really supposed to exist. Bulldogs, you know, the wrinkles on a bulldog's face. How does that happen? I'll tell you how. Because about 30, 40,000 years ago, no, sooner, maybe 10, 15,000 years ago, when we started farming animals, a dog was bred so that he could go into a pen with a farmer. And if the farmer had a randy, aggressive bull, this dog was resilient enough that he could grab onto the bull's nose, and no matter how hard the bull shook, the dog would not let go, allowing the farmer to escape. That turned into the bulldog. The wrinkles on the face slowly evolved through breeding, because the original bulldogs would grab onto a bull's nose and there would be so much blood flowing off the bull's nose that the dog could drown in the blood. So these wrinkles were evolved in their faces so that the blood would drain off, and that's what a bulldog is. Dogs aren't real. They are domesticated animals of pleasure, and I love them. I love them dearly. Cats are a different story. We were hunter-gatherers for hundreds of thousands of years. Cats only started hanging about with humans at the arrival of agriculture, which isn't really that long ago, maybe 50, 60,000 years, I could be off there. When humans developed agriculture, that is the ability to farm, it is the first time we had surplus. Hunter-gatherers didn't have surplus. They ate and found, they found what they got and they ate it. When humans started farming, we had silos of grain for the first time. We were able to make too much. And when you have a silo of grain, you have vermin that hangs around the village. And cats started hanging around with us to get rid of the rats. So cats haven't been around with us long enough to actually be fully domesticated. The ancestor of the domestic cat is known as the African wild cat. And if you look up photographs of the African wild cat, they are identical to what we call a house cat. They haven't evolved. They haven't changed. They haven't, maybe give it another 100,000 years and cats will evolve into something similar to what dogs are now. But right now, cats are still kind of, they're semi-wild. A cat will engage with you on its terms only, whereas a dog will be fully loyal. A cat is like, fuck you. I'm taking the piss out of you. You don't own me, I own you. So there's an independence in cats that I enjoy in that respect. But I also love the unconditional love and loyalty from a dog. And I refuse to compare and contrast the two. They're beautiful animals and I love them both dearly. Soapy asks, what's your opinion on modern hip-hop, i.e. mumble rap, in comparison to old school? Also, what's your stance on Irish rap, hip-hop as a whole? That's a tough one. You know, I love hip-hop music. I've been listening to hip-hop music since I was a child. I love old school hip-hop music. 90% of anything is going to be shit, right? So here's something to consider. Like, a lot of mumble rap isn't, it's not my vibe. But I will always give it a chance. I will never write it off just because it sounds weird and different. 90% of it is going to be shit. And because it's happening in the here and now, you're going to be exposed to that 90%. And it'll take 5 or 6 years to look back and see what the cream of the crop is. But just remember, old school hip-hop, which we now look back on as being classic, like Public Enemy, N.W.A., this was held in the same contempt that mumble rap is being held in now. And 90% of that was shit too. It's just, it's hard to find that 90% because it just doesn't get reprinted, or it's hard to find on Spotify. But if you look hard enough, you will find the shit from the golden age of hip hop. I have a general rule. Anytime a load of black Americans have consensus about music, historically, they are always right. Always. So for that reason, no matter what happens in hip-hop music, I will always give it the benefit of the doubt and my ears, because history has shown that African-American culture is consistently on the ball musically, even when it's new and shocking. Irish hip-hop, I think that's fucking flying it at the moment. It's certainly a hell of a lot better than it was 10 years ago. You've got Russ Angano family from Limerick, Hair Squad up in Dublin, fucking class. Your man Mango up in Dublin. Lethal Dialect, one of the best lyricists the country has ever seen. He doesn't go by Lethal Dialect anymore, he's going by his own name, Paul Allwright. And there's a rapper down here in Limerick called Dirt Davis, who's a fucking genius. So Irish hip-hop is in a good state right now. Tina Bay would like to know, what are your thoughts on ASMR, Autonomous Sensory Meridian Response, mostly found on YouTube via video and audio, created to help relax people or elicit other responses? I fucking love ASMR. If you don't know what ASMR is, there are these weird videos on YouTube where people will whisper into a microphone or speak a certain way, and certain people who listen receive kind of tingles in their brains when they hear this. This podcast is very much influenced by ASMR. I spent a lot of time perfecting the exact sound of how I might want my microphone to be, to get the exact bass response out of my voice, to use aural stimuli to allow you, the listener, to get a very relaxing experience. And this, to an extent, is ASMR. Now, I don't get ASMR tingles when I listen to it. I just like the way it sounds. Some people get full-on tingles. I don't. There's an ASMR channel, a fella called Ephemeral Rift, and I fucking adore his videos. It's like Samuel Beckett. He has elevated ASMR to incredibly absurd, bizarre theatre. He's got a 3 hour long video of him touching a pineapple, and he has the pineapple mic'd up, and all you can hear is these pineapple sounds. I fucking love that. I love living in a world where there's a 3 hour video of a man touching a pineapple. I like that. He's got an hour and a half long video where he dresses up as a rhino and makes, with a mortar and pestle, he makes this weird elixir, and then it's you, the observer, are trapped in this temple of the white rhino, and he whispers into your ear for an hour and a half about giving you an elixir. It's fucking mental. It's madness. And I just love it. It's so beautiful. And I think if Samuel Beckett was around, I think he would love it, because there's such a Beckett vibe of some of the ASMR stuff that's out there. Really mad shit. That's some of my favourite entertainment at the moment, is just, I would watch an ASMR video for a fucking hour and marvel at the fact that it just exists. Niley asks, talk about DMT. DMT, I don't know an awful amount about DMT. DMT is, it's a very special hallucinogenic drug, and it is unique amongst all other drugs in that it often elicits identical responses in everybody who uses it. People who use DMT are find it through ceremonies like an ayahuasca ceremony. They are transported to a world outside of reality where they meet things called elves in the machine, which are often described as basketball-sized objects that are glowing with jewels, and they reveal to them the secrets of their life and the secrets of the universe. And a buddy of mine did DMT about 6 months ago, and it genuinely changed his life because he had that experience while using it. It's very, very interesting. The science that's gone into looking into DMT, it's certainly being treated. Some people don't even call it a drug. Some people believe that it's like a little remote control for the quantum fabric that lies behind reality. That it's more than a drug, that it's a gateway into multiple universes. And this is evidenced by the fact that people have the same experience. And look, I don't know enough about it, mainly because so much of the information out there about DMT is, it's kind of like conspiracy theory shit. Do you know when you want to learn about conspiracy theories, but the only information out there is a 5-hour long YouTube video by a lunatic, so you're not going to give your time towards that. There isn't, it's hard to find concise, decent DMT information out there. Would I do it? Probably not. As a result of my propensity towards anxiety, I am not interested in hallucinogens of any description. I'm not interested in any drug that would allow me to lose control over a prolonged period of time. I don't think that would go well with my anxiety, so I'll have to leave DMT off. However, I do meditate, and I have had experiences in meditation which have been transcendental and have brought me close to a feeling of intense meaning or belonging or Jesus. I haven't done it now in a good while because I run instead of meditating. But when I was meditating, I used to meditate down by the river, the Plassey River, where Yerti Ahern's couch is. It's a little beachy area there at the back of UL. And I used to go down there and sit down there every single day and do a 15-minute meditation. And one day, after about 6 weeks of very intense meditation, I woke up from it, and the first thing that I saw was a nettle. And my entire being was overcome with this incredibly intense sense of love and empathy for this nettle. And it's like I truly and deeply understood at the core of my being that me and this nettle were one, that we were part of some same system. And it was phenomenal. It was amazing. An intense loving empathy for a nettle. And I know that sounds insane, but that's what I felt at that moment. That nettle, it was like it was like the universe told me a little personal in-joke, like nudged me and said, see, you and that nettle there, you're the same. You and that nettle are part of a system. And you know what? Like, it's not wrong. Like, that nettle breathes out carbon dioxide. Or sorry, that nettle, I breathe carbon dioxide out of my mouth when I'm meditating, and that nettle breathes in that carbon dioxide and gives oxygen out, and I breathe that in. So there is a holistic symbiotic relationship between me and that nettle. But I felt an emotional, intense empathy with it, and I imagine that's what DMT is like. So for me personally, I'm happy sticking with the meditation for now. I don't think I need any chemical assistance, but I'd quite happily listen to other people's stories about it. I find that quite interesting. I just realised there that little nettle analogy does hark back to the earlier part of the podcast where I was talking about the collectivism and holistic thinking and Eastern thinking and how much on the ball they were. Yeah, there's a symbiotic relationship between us and plants. That is a fact. They breathe in what we breathe out, and back and forth, we are one. Simple as that. You know, I'm in my hand at the moment, even I've got a plastic pen. Plastic is nothing but the bones of dinosaurs. Plastic comes from oil. Oil is fossil fuels. What's fossil fuels? Only dead dinosaurs. So next time you pick up a piece of plastic, even though it's a completely synthetic man-made material, it is not possible without the bones of a stegosaurus. It's all symbiotic. It is all, everything is related. Everything is part of a flowing system of oneness. Jesus Christ, that makes me sound up my own hole. All right. I leave you off, so. What are we... That's about, what is an hour and 10 minutes? That's not too bad for you. Please keep subscribing to the podcast and please leave some nice reviews if you enjoyed it. If you're feeling generous, donate money to the podcast's Patreon page, www.patreon.com/thebuyingbypodcast, or not, only if you want to, lads, I don't mind. And look after yourself for the week ahead. If you have a bit of time off for Christmas, enjoy it, use that time properly, no matter what way that is. And like I said earlier on with the exercise, if you're becoming too vegetative at home with your time off, just be aware, keep be mindful around your own mental health around that, because having too much time off can, if you're used to being busy and you have a big chunk of time off, that time off where you think you're actually using it to rest, you can get a little bit of death anxiety or an existential anxiety, and it can cause you to look inward negatively, because the daily grind is a distraction from the inevitable chaos of our own death. Alright, I'll talk to you next week. Yart. Oh, and keep asking questions. I love it when you ask me questions on Twitter, at Rubber Bandits. That was my favourite part of the podcast, answering your questions. You cunts.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.